This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To, Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, extending a very special welcome to everybody just joining us around North America on Sirius Channel 93. For those of you who have been with us for the past 3 hours with our live racing coverage on XM 208, welcome back to the program. And of course, everybody listening worldwide on our website, horseracingradio.net. We welcome you to the program here tonight as well. And going to be a good one. Really looking forward to this show here. As you know, we take you inside the game from the trainer's perspective every single week here on Trainer Talk. And tonight, no exception. I will be joined by Bill Kaplan in the first half of the program and Jose Garofalo in the second half of the show tonight. So without further ado, let's get started. Bill Kaplan has trained 564 career winners with purse earnings of more than $15 million, including the 2011 Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Sprint winner and Eclipse champion, Musical Romance. He's nice enough to spend a little time with me here on Trainer Talk today. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hey, nice to be with you, Mike.
Yeah, happy to have you on board and really looking forward to hearing your story. And it's interesting because the story of Bill Kaplan and your journey to becoming a trainer is extremely unique. You didn't start out necessarily wanting to be a trainer. Instead, you had several different careers before moving to the racetrack, let's say. And the first of those was in the United States Army.
Yes, that's right. I was drafted actually into the Army, but then after spending a couple of weeks doing guard duty in KP, I decided I got to do something else. So I went to OCS and became an officer in the Army and spent 3 years after that in the Army and also touring Vietnam.
Yeah, I was going to say 1966. The first thing that comes to mind when you think about the late 60s was Vietnam. And after becoming a lieutenant, I believe, was that the rank that you held?
Correct.
Yeah, and then you went to Vietnam. You arrived there just in time for the Tet Offensive. So timing-wise, it was a bit hairy for you. You know, we hear so many horror stories of veterans who were unable to block out, you know, some of those horrors of Vietnam. Does that still have an effect on you in your daily life?
No, it really doesn't. It never really did, I don't think. Although when my family did tell me when I first got back, I was a little bit short-tempered. But I don't dream about it or have any problems from it. I don't have any lasting effect. So I'm one of the lucky ones, I guess.
You know, I talk about this a lot on our shows, Bill, but every time I seem to reference a horse that you have running in a race, or we tend to talk about any of your horses that you're training, I will always mention that you're a highly decorated war hero, and I want to personally thank you for your service to the country. But you are the recipient of a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, that's true. The Bronze Star was given to me, but it was an interesting situation. I was in a platoon. I had a platoon of tanks, or dusters. They were twin 40-millimeter cannons on top of tanks. And we got into a firefight, and I got wounded. And they wanted to medevac me out, and I wouldn't go on the first helicopter because the stuff was still coming in. So that helicopter actually got shot down, so I was very lucky. And I went on the second helicopter. And I got a Bronze Star for the wound, and they also gave me, a Purple Heart for the wound and the Bronze Star for refusing to leave my post while I'm wounded, which I eventually did, but I didn't want to go on the first helicopter. But yeah, that was quite an experience in Vietnam. No one can really understand what it feels like to hear bullets and going over your head and shrapnel going around you. So it's a total frightening experience, and I'm glad I survived it.
Yeah, what does that Bronze Star and Purple Heart mean to you now, some 46 years later?
Well, I'm proud that I attained them, but it really hasn't affected much of anything, and just proud that I did serve in the Army and then during a war, and it wasn't the favorite war of the United States, if there is such a thing, but I did my duty, so I feel like I paid the price up to a certain point.
Well, even after leaving the Army and getting into other things, training horses still really wasn't on the agenda, was it?
No, I came back out of the Army, and I had the GI Bill, of course, so I went to school to become an accountant, which I did become a certified public accountant, and I worked for Arthur Anderson before they got in trouble, and also had my own practice for a while. So I became a CPA with accounting, and did that for about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, but even at that time, I think I read this somewhere, that even at that time when you were working with Arthur Anderson, there was still a feeling maybe of being a bit incomplete. You were still looking for something else?
Yes, I wasn't really happy doing that. So I was looking for something else. So I had more GI Bill left from school. So I took flying lessons and became a pilot and then a professional pilot. And I left Arthur Anderson and I came to Florida. And I was a flight instructor first in Florida. And then I opened my own airline. I used my accounting background plus my flying ability to open my own little commuter airline. We flew people from the hotels in South Florida to Disney World for the day and back. And I grew that from myself as one employee to 20 employees and 8 airplanes. And it lasted real good for about 4 years until they opened up deregulation, and Pan Am decided to fly from Fort Lauderdale to Orlando for $19, and I was charging $99 round trip. So that didn't last that long. But while I was flying and running the airline, I had made some money in the first few years, and I was wondering, well, what should I do, you know? And my uncle, who was very big into horse racing, said, "Bill, why don't you buy some racehorses? You know, you got some disposable money, and that's most of the time what you need in owning racehorses." And so I did that, and I went to all the race course, and I met Newcomb Green, an old-time trainer, and bought a horse from him, and that's how I got started in the horse business as an owner.
So you never really considered getting involved in racing until after the airplane industry came to an end, and then you decided, well, you know, why not?
That's correct. I was about 31 years old at the time, or 32 years old, when I got my first racehorse.
When were you first introduced to the sport, Bill?
Oh, my uncle used to take me to Aqueduct in Belmont. Even when I was underage, back then you had to be, I think, 16 or 18 to get into the track. And he was a addicted gambler, and he played the horses all the time, and I enjoyed it, and I used to go with them all the time. So I always loved the horse racing industry, and I actually did think about doing something. It's funny. I'm 6'3" now. When I was 13 years old, I was 5'2", and I loved horseback riding, and I used to go down to the beach at Bergen Beach in Brooklyn and ride racehorses, and ride, not racehorses, barn horses, and race them on the beach. And I think, maybe I could be a jockey. But then I grew about a foot in the next year and a half. That went down the toilet. But that was the first time I thought about horse racing, when I was about 13 or 14.
Did you still continue to follow the sport as a fan, even though you were in the Army and then working as an accountant and even with the airline industry?
Yeah, I was big into watching the big horses back then. You know, Kelso was big, and, of course, Secretariat, and so those horses run, and I always loved it as far as that came. But I didn't really give it serious thought to going into it on the owner or trainer side until I got the airline and talked to my uncle. Because, again, I thought about it as a jock when I was 5'2", but then didn't think about the other side until I had some disposable income.
And your uncle was just a horse player. He wasn't in the game at all in terms of being a trainer
No.
or anything like that?
I am first-generation horseman.
Wow. Well, it's a great story. Bill Kaplan joining me on Trainer Talk, presented by Fazy Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So your uncle encourages you to get into the racehorse business. You buy your first horse. What was the name of your first horse?
Brash Doctor.
Did he win?
No, well, that's an interesting story, too. I ran him probably about six or seven times. I still had the airline at the time, by the way.
Okay.
And the airline was starting to go really badly. So I took the filly and another horse I had acquired by that time and sent it up to the farm so I could go back full-time to the airline and not have to think about too much on the horses and try to save the airline, but it went downhill pretty quick there. So when the airline was just about out, I said, well, let me bring these horses back. And I really loved what I was doing as an owner and see if I could become a trainer. So I hired an assistant trainer from somebody, put these two horses on a local farm down here in South Florida. It was actually called Sterling Road Training Center way back. Now it's a complex. And I hired this guy and I said, listen, what I want to do is I want to work with you every day with these horses and I want to become a trainer and I'm willing to pay you just to teach me everything you know. And I did that for 4 months with him and learned enough where it wasn't too dangerous. And then I went out, and these were my own horses, and I went out, and second time I saddled my filly, she won. And I said to myself, wow, this is an easy game. But it took about 8 months till I won another race, so it ain't that easy.
This game will humble you in a hurry, won't it?
Oh, you ain't kidding. Everyone has heard the expression about it's like riding a roller coaster. There's ups and downs. And it's so very true, because the ups are exhilarating, the downs are devastating, and it seems like you stay on a lot more downs than ups. So it's a very, very tough business and tough to make a living at, but the rewards, if you can stick with it and get the right horses and do the best job you can get lucky too.
What do you remember about your first day on the job, Bill?
First day on the job. My first day on the job, actually on the farm when I was trying to become a trainer, and I hadn't taken out the trainer's license or anything. This was back in 1978, I guess it was, 78, 79, because I took out my trainer's license in 1980, I believe. I remember, not being that comfortable around the horses, but he was showing me everything, and of course I got kicked one time, and I was a little dangerous early with him, but... that was a tremendous experience because you're really, by having my hands on them totally all the time, more in the evening, I learned a little bit about horses. Now, my first time when I got to the races and I saddled one, I was extremely nervous and excited. And first time I won, it was total exhilaration. You feel like you really accomplished something.
And what was the name of that horse? That wasn't Brash Doctor, right? Brash Doctor
was
the
Brash
horse you
Doctor.
Owned. Oh, that was Brash Doctor, the first one you trained.
Yes, the other horse that we claimed before I sent him to the farm was a horse called Ronnie's Girl,
okay,
who I wound up breeding. She never came back because she had a problem. And that was the only horse I ever... No, two horses I bred. I'm sorry, I bred two horses. And she threw a horse that I trained that turned out to be a stake horse. So I got lucky in that area, too.
So how many horses did you have when you first started on your own?
One. I came back with Brash Doctor. And then after she won, I bought another horse out at Sterling Road Training Center because I still didn't have stalls at Boulder.
Okay.
And another horse I bought that, a colt, that I think I won one race with. So I started out with two horses of my own, no clients. And that's where we went from back then.
How'd you build it up?
Well, let's see. The horse I told you I bred, I was sitting in a box at Calder, my box, and someone sat in the box. And when I got there, someone was sitting in my box. So I said to this gentleman, if you're going to sit here, you're going to have to buy a racehorse. And his name was Frank Sheehy. He's since passed away. And he said, well, I'd be interested in that. So I said, okay, I got one coming in that I just bred. And that was the Southern Velvet, who was by out of Ronnie's Girl, turned out to be a stake horse. So he bought into her when she came into the racetrack, and we went from there. So also I met some other people in racing and met my big owner, Herb Elkins, who's a Hall of Fame South Florida owner, back then in that area too. And he, as his trainer, had left town, and he had about four horses with a trainer going up north, and he asked me if I wanted to train them, and I took those over. So that's how I got to six at that time.
Well, and then along comes a little horse by the name of Seacliff. Would he be the horse that you would say really put Bill Kaplan on the map?
Yeah, I guess so. He's the one that took me to first classic races, and he was owned by Mr. Elkins, who was the one of the first owners I had. And he was quite a horse. He won his first four races undefeated, and that included sweeping the Stallion Stakes, they're called. And then we went up to running the Breeders' Cup, and he was making a move to win it in the Breeders' Cup, and he bled. Back then, they didn't have Lasix in New York, and he wasn't on Lasix anyway, I don't believe. And he bled in that race, but he went on to win some more stake races. Yeah, he put me on the map, took me to the big show.
Yeah, talk about how exciting that must have been for you, being a relatively new trainer at the time. I know you had some other horses, obviously, but then to get a horse like Seacliff and to find out what it's really like to have a good horse in the barn, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it was really an amazing experience with him, because the pressure was pretty big on me. I was a young trainer at the time. I was probably like 32 or something like that, 33 years old. And the press was constantly over, especially after we won the first two legs of the Stallion Stakes, and we were going for a sweep, which is very, very rarely done. At that time, there was only one other horse that had done that. And they were off. I was doing interviews every day, and I was getting really nervous going into the final leg, and we won that one. So now I'm looking to go to, before I won the last race, I said to myself, I got to get somebody that's calmer. We're going to change jocks. No, that's not correct. I'm sorry. That's a different horse. Sorry. Let me go back a little bit here. I made a little mistake there. So, no, we went to New York for the Breeders' Cup. And I remember the race like it was yesterday, and he was about fifth or sixth. It was in the slop, which he liked. And I had my glasses watching him. And then he started to make a move going to the 3/8 pole, and the announcer named him coming on. And I got so nervous, I couldn't hold the glasses steady. I couldn't keep an eye on the race. So I didn't see what was happening from the 3/8 pole because I was shaking like a leaf. And then I found out he faded as he turned for home because he bled. But the excitement of having a good horse is really amazing. But I'll tell you something that people don't realize. Something as exciting as running in a big stake race, for me, is almost the same running a horse for the first time that I've trained. First-time starters are very exciting because you put all the training into them, and you hope you've got everything right, and you hope they're going to behave right. So it's really an exciting area also, almost as much as a stake race. Of course, a classic race is different than the pressures on you. But Seacliff did start me on a pretty good run. I had a couple of really good horses prior to him, graded stake winners, but he's the one that got me on the national map.
Yeah, I can imagine that you still have those same butterflies, maybe not to the extent that you would have them in a classic race, but you still have the same butterflies when you're watching a horse go to the post for the first time, knowing all the work and all the time that you put into that horse.
Oh, it's absolutely true. It's really exciting, and you hope you've got everything right. And, of course, if you have a horse that really has no talent, that's a different story. But even an average horse, you still hope if you've got them in the right place that everything's going to go well. Horse is going to behave the way you've trained them and not do anything to hurt his chances of winning. And then, as I tell all owners that come into the business, why to be in this business, I have the perfect analogy, especially for men, and I'm not saying women aren't the same way, but especially for men, when we're young and in high school and college, we're playing all kinds of sports, and we're getting adrenaline rushes when we catch a touchdown pass or sink a long basket or win with a home run. And that excitement, that adrenaline rush you lose as you get older, and you get over 35, 40 years old, and you're not competitive anymore. And you're not going to get a rush playing golf. It's not the same thing. However, if you have a horse of your own turning for home, your colors, and he's making a move to the front, it's the same kind of adrenaline rush that you had when you were scoring touchdowns as a kid. And I don't think there's anything else you can do as you get over 40 years old that can bring that back to you. So I think that's a tremendous advantage for anyone who wants to get into the business and what it's really about.
I've had several jockeys tell me that, Bill, that when you start winning big races, any races really, but especially the big races, you get that adrenaline rush and it becomes like a drug. And that's why jockeys will always try to push themselves to come back from these injuries, no matter how severe they may be. And it sounds like it's the very same thing for a trainer as you're watching your horse make that move and then come to the finish line first.
Yeah, there's very few trainers that quit this game before they have to be carried out almost, because it really is probably the best job in the world. And there are some negatives. I mean, it's very bad hours. You're up at 4 o'clock every morning and it's 7 days a week and 365 days a year and all that. But as far as the rewards and the job itself, you're working with athletes on a national stage and you're in the major leagues. I mean, where else can you do that? I mean, no normal person can go out and be a coach of a baseball team or a basketball team, but you can take these horses from when they're first young horses and teach them everything they have to know about racing and watch them progress, and it's so rewarding. I mean, the thrills of it are just amazing. My best part of my day is getting to work in the morning at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning and getting started out here. Even training him and watching him go. So it's a great job. It's a very hard job to make money at. It's not a good job in that area, but it's a great job for personal reward. And same thing with owners. Most owners don't really go into the business to make money, to make profits. They go in for the thrill of it, the excitement of it, the reward of it, with the hope, of course, of making money. But I tell every new owner that comes into the business, you should be coming into this business with discretionary money, because most owners can't make a profit in this business. And nowadays, most trainers can't make a profit because the costs are so high to keep these going, and the owners can't afford the day rates that you have to do sometimes. So it becomes a very hard business to stay in as a trainer, money wise. But as far as rewards in the business, there is no better job, I don't believe, in the world. The training racehorses.
Well, with all that being said, Bill, have you had to change your approach to training horses or even to running your business from when you first started in the game?
Well, I had a big advantage. As I told you, I was a certified public accountant, and I knew the numbers. And I worked, always careful about the numbers, and I don't have to pay a lot of costs that other people in the business might have. But as far as training, I've trained certain training techniques, and as you get more experience in business, the more you learn. But my approach is very similar, and especially my particular approach in the business is a little unique. I'm not a claiming trainer. I buy 2-year-olds in training, and I buy all these horses out of OBS, Ocala Breeder Sales Company, and I don't do any claiming, and I develop these young horses, and I do that every year. I'll buy 10 to 20 2-year-olds and develop them and then go on with their, that's how I've had my success. It's not the way 99% of the trainers don't do that. They'll take them from every area. They'll breeders and breed them by yearlings, claim horses. So everyone has a different approach, but my approach for quite a while since I've been in this business, I'd say at least the last 20, 25 years has been to buy 2-year-olds and train.
Well, you were able to get back to the top of the mountain in 2011 with your champion, Musical Romance, who won the Philly and Mare Sprint that year. Tell me the story of Musical Romance and her career and how she came to be.
Well, she was a 2-year-old that we bought out of the OBS sale in April. And she was a $22,000 purchase, very reasonable purchase. And we brought it to the track right from the sale. And the second day galloping on the training track at Calder, with my significant other up, by the way, as the exercise rider, she broke her pastern. Right, and she broke her pastern as I was syndicating her. I had an owner with me in the golf cart who was going to buy 25%.
Wow.
I had already sold out 50% of it to Pinnacle Racing, who owned the other half of her. And I had 50%, and I only want to keep 25% of any horse that I have. So I was going to sell this 25% that I part of my 50% to this other owner, and he was with me when she actually came up lame on the racetrack. So he said, "Well, I'm not interested." I said, "I don't blame you." And we brought her back. We sent her up for surgery. She had to put 4 screws in her pastern. And I, in my mind, you know, you kind of write those off that they're not going to be much. And, you know, I had no way I could sell any part of what I owned her. But she came back in 3 months, and we started training her. And she started to show me right away that there was a lot of talent here. And she was breezing beautifully and everything. So we went on and raced her and started out actually with her going long. She was a very aggressive and precocious horse. She always wanted to go up to the front. And we were running her, trying to get her to rate and trying to get her to relax. And she just wouldn't relax for us. But we were racing her. And we finally found the way to do it. It was just put her in a race going long and stick her behind the last horse. And we tried that. She won. And then from there on in, we knew that's the way she had to run, is have someone covering her up. I can tell you this now. I couldn't tell you this if while she was still running, because people would know that and then stop me from getting covered up. But anyways, every race that we ever rode her, ran her, we covered her up. And we started out going long with her, and she won a stake, Sweet Tricky Dancer, going long on the turf. And then we were having, it's a funny story, a friend of mine had a horse that I was running against a lot in those stakes, and she was beating me a lot. I beat her in the Sweet Tricky Dancer, she was beating me in these other stakes. So then one day we came up, and there were two stakes entering that day that I nominated to both. One was a sprint, and one was a distance race. And my friend had his horse in the distance race. I said, I'm going to duck her this time. I'm going to go back and sprint and try her sprinting. And she ran lights out in the sprint, and then from then on I said, we've got a sprinter here. And we were able to tuck her in behind somebody in the pocket, and she blasted her at the end. So from then on in, she sprinted, and she just ran an unbelievable record. And then in her Breeders' Cup year as a 4-year-old, we ran her 9 races prior to the Breeders' Cup. And those races, she was ran perfect trips every day with her jock, Juan Labor, knew her very well, and always stayed in the pocket and always blasted through splitting horses, going through the inside or going around them in the last eighth of a mile. And it was a style that she had for her entire career once we started her sprinting. And it worked in the Breeders' Cup, too, because if you remember the Breeders' Cup, she was stuck behind a wall of horses turning her home, and she just barreled her way through them to win it. And she was a remarkable filly. She actually enjoyed the competition. She actually, Juan told me, she actually liked splitting horses and bouncing around off of them and getting eyeball to eyeball and digging in against them. So she was a unique horse that had a tremendous amount of heart, goes along with a lot of ability and a lot of versatility and every other good aspect the horse can have.
Bill, believe it or not, only about 1 minute left here. This time has really flown by. We could spend another half hour, so you have to promise up the road to come back on, and we'll continue to talk about some of the outstanding horses you've been part of, including Musical Romance. But I can only imagine very quickly that if your binoculars were shaking with Seacliff, they must have really been shaking with Musical Romance.
Yes, it is. And by the way, I got one right now that's going to probably run Saturday Tampa Bay Derby. Name is East Hall. He ran 4th in the Fountain of Youth. So he's on the Derby trail now, and we're hoping he's our next big horse. But he's probably going to run Saturday at Tampa Bay Derby. So everybody watch him go.
All right. Well, Bill, all the best with East Hall on Saturday. And again, can't thank you enough for taking the time here on Trainer Talk tonight. Enjoyable to hear your story, my friend, and all the best moving forward.
Always a pleasure, Mike.
All right, Bill Kaplan here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. An amazing person, great story. Decorated war hero from Vietnam. Thanks for everything, Bill. We appreciate it. All right, second half of Trainer Talk coming up next here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Stay tuned.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Where will you be this summer? The Fasig Tipton 2014 yearling sales will be here before we know it, so make plans now. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky will be held July 14th. In 2013, the sale boasted an average of more than $89,000 and a median of $72,000, and the percentage rate of return of 43% was the third highest of any yearling sale in North America. The Saratoga sale on August 4th and 5th is always one of the top international yearling marketplaces. The sales $295,000 average in 2013 maintains its leadership role, and with the highest percentage of profitable yearlings among all sales in North America this past year, it's the only place to be this August. New York bred yearlings are in the spotlight August 9th and 10th in Saratoga with a $430,000 average and major increases in both average and median in 2013. The New York bred sale is the most productive auction for the cream of the New York bred crop. So where will you be this summer?
Since 2000, runners by Pin Oak Stallions have won some of racing's most important stakes races and include Eclipse and Sovereign Award champions. Pin Oak is home to leading sire Broken Vow, sire of over 100 stakes horses, and Sky Classic, sire of 17% stakes horses. Pin Oak also stands Cowboy Cow, a young grade one millionaire. Pin Oak Stud, stakes success is our goal.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
This is the Horse Racing Radio Network, your home for racing's biggest events.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, along with my producer, Lee Delapina. Really fun visit with Bill Kaplan in the first half of the program, and really looking forward to the second half of the show. Going to be joined in just a moment by trainer Jose Garofalo, the man who has trained 325 career winners, including this year's Fountain of Youth winner, Wildcat Red, hoping to be the Florida Derby winner coming up. More than $6.7 million in purse earnings to their credit, and the native of Venezuela, nice enough to spend some time here on Trainer Talk tonight. Jose, thanks for taking the time.
Hi, Mike. Hi, everybody there. Thank you for having me again in your program.
Yeah, happy to have you back on board. And the last time you and I spoke, you were smiling from ear to ear after leading Wildcat Red into the winner's circle of the Fountain of Youth. Has that smile gone away yet?
No, it's still on. The smile is still on my face because I'm very optimistic for the next race. Hopefully, everything is going to be all right for the Florida Derby.
Well, take me back to the beginning, Jose, and tell me about getting into horses. Obviously, your family was involved, so you kind of had it in your pedigree. Take me back to the beginning and growing up in Venezuela, how it all came to be.
Well, the first time I have a contact with a racehorse was around the 1970, 1971. Those days, my father has a horse. He was an owner of a filly and one of his friends' barn in La Rinconada in Caracas. And I used to go with him in the morning to the breezes in the morning. We used to go in the morning early to see the breezes of his horses. So those days, the first time I entered in the barn in La Rinconada, I remember like if it was yesterday, but as soon as I saw the horses, I was impressed, and I think that was the moment when I fall in love with the horses, with the business. So I remember very clearly that day when I went with my father to his barn, And I think that was the switch that made me feel, to make me feel sure of what I was going to do in the future.
That
was the very, very beginning. That's the first memories that I have, with the contact with the horses. Before that, we used to go to the farm, to my father's farm. I used to get along with the horses, but not the race horses. So then the story continues.
What did you like most about being around the horses at that age, Jose?
Well, I enjoy the animal. I enjoy the contact with the animal. I love the horse. I love the nobility of the horse. The way they give you all they have for us, for the business, and I appreciate that. It's an animal that can give us everything, even their lives. To give us a lot of satisfactions in this business. So I like the animal. I'm an animal lover in general. I love every animal, but especially the race horse is the one that caught my attention since I was a kid.
What did your dad try to teach you when you were hanging out around the barns and watching the breezes? What was it that he tried to teach you when you were that age?
Well, the first thing that they always taught me, it was this respect for the animals. Being a farmer, my father also has a cattle farm. Being a farmer and a people that live out of the animals, the first thing that they taught me was the respect for the animal. Even if they train for you or they work for you or you sell them or you have to live out of them, you have to do business with them, you have to respect the life of the animal. In this case, you have to respect the horse race. And you have to try to give them the best environment, the best situation for them, because they give you everything to you. And I've been raised because of the animals, help my family to be there, to be a decent family, to have an education, to have the food on the table. And that's the first thing that I learned from my father, the respect for the animals.
Were there any other members of your family that were involved or are involved with racing right now?
No, you know, it's a funny story, because I have two sisters and a brother, and any of them were involved with the business. I have a sister who is a medical doctor. The other one is a dentist. My brother is a chemical engineer, but they have nothing to do with the horse business. They used to go to the racetrack to see the races. They used to go to the farm, but that's fun. They just went for fun, not professionally. They're not involved in the business. So I was the only one who had that interest for the horse business, and I went to college. I have my degree, like I told you before, but I decided to stay here with the horses.
Yeah, it's interesting that you decided to go to college and get a degree. It was in law, so you have your law degree, but that was, even when you were going to school, that was never really what you wanted to do, was it?
Yeah, I was sure. I was sure since the beginning. I like to study, because it improves you as a person. It makes you grow as a person. It gives you a different view of a life. It's good for your own personality. But what I really wanted to do was always be a trainer, be in contact with the horses. And I'm lucky, because I have the chance to do it, and I have the support of my family, of my father, and the support of my owners, and I'm here now. I'm here still trying to make a way of living of this beautiful business.
What was the reaction of your parents when you told them that this is what you wanted to do for a living?
Well, you know, my parents, they always support us. They always give us the the chance to decide what we're gonna do. They never had any influences on us. They let us do whatever we wanted to do. They let us develop as a human being, as a person, the way we wanted. So they never put any limitations on us. So my father for sure was very happy. But I remember his words when I told him that I was going back to the racetrack. His words were that I picked the most difficult job in the world to be a horse trainer. But he was happy. And the bottom of his heart, he was happy that I was staying with him in the horse business.
Yeah, I thought it was great when you told me the story about graduating with your law degree, and the very next day you turned around, you handed the degree to your mother, you handed the medal to your father, and the next day you were on the racetrack.
That's exactly what I did, and I'm still here on the racetrack.
Now, one thing,
happily ever after.
Talking with Jose Garofalo on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton, one thing, Jose, that caught my attention as you and I had a chance to speak when I was in Florida was the fact that you attended trainer school in Venezuela, and we don't have anything like that here in the United States. It's a completely different approach to getting involved with this aspect of the business, isn't it?
Yeah, it's totally different. We used to have in Venezuela a very good trainer school. You have to go to high school and get a degree from high school to get into the trainer school. We used to study a lot of very important matters like anatomy, physiology, and things like that to become a trainer. And at the same time, when we were in the school, we had to work in a barn. We have to be working for a trainer before getting our license there. So I spent 2 years in the trainer school, and before getting the trainer school, I spent like two or three more years as an assistant trainer for one of the biggest trainers down there in those days. So we have to study a lot. I remember that we have a lot of tests, and we have to have a lot of practices. We'll have a class of practices every day. So it was hard those days. I don't think they have the schools, the trainer school nowadays, but those days was a very important training school in Venezuela, and it was good because we have a very good generation of trainers that we were educated down there in those years. I'm talking about the 80s. Between the 85 and the 90s, maybe. Since then, I don't think that they have that kind of schools anymore in my country.
Did you actually race horses in Venezuela before coming to the United States?
Pardon me?
Did you race horses in your name
in
Venezuela?
Yeah. Well, I ran there. I won like 100 races there before coming here. I had a nice barn there, but I decided to quit because the situation in my country, the business was starting to get bad. There was a lot of gambling, a lot of problem with the bookies down there. So I decided to quit because it was a tough business those days. And at the same time, it was for me a challenge to come here to the United States. And I have the chance to come up here. A couple of owners gave me the chance to come up here. And then I'm here. And then I started training here in 1999. I'm still here trying to do the best that I can.
What do you remember about coming to the United States for the very first time?
Well, when I came in 1999, I was here before. I forgot to mention that when I finished the trainer school and the law school in Venezuela in 1998, I come up here to work for a trainer here in Florida, and I spent like 3 years here working for a trainer. Actually, I get my trainer license those days, but I went back to Venezuela because we have the farm in those days, I wanted to go back to my country and work in my farm and have my own barn, which I did in 1991. Then I spent like 6 or 7 years training in Venezuela, and then I come back here. But when I came back in 1999, I pretty much knew where I was coming. I knew that it was going to be difficult. I knew that we need the support of the owners because it's kind of expensive for us to come here and buy horses. But we made it. We made it. Finally, after a few years, we established a nice barn, and we've been here competing with everybody in this country, in this beautiful country.
Well, you know, you didn't waste any time getting to the winner's circle when you first came to the United States. Wasn't it your very first starter?
Yeah,
ended up winning?
That was a very nice story because the first horse that I claimed in the United States, the first race that I ran, I won it. So that was a very good stimulus to keep going. I was a nice horse. I claimed the horse for 12.5. I get. As far as I remember, for 12,500, the horse ended up winning like 5 or 6 races for me, and we made very good money out of the horse. I don't know if I mentioned the name of the horse before, Red Former.
Yep.
So winning your first, I think that I won my first 2 or 3 races here, so that was very encouraging because as soon as I got here, I started winning races.
Yeah.
And I wasn't expecting that. It was a nice surprise to start winning winning back-to-back races.
How difficult was it to build up a clientele and to build your business having come here from another country?
Well, for us, it's a little bit more difficult. The first thing is because of it's more expensive here because of the money exchange. That's the first thing. Secondly, the mentality of the Venezuelan owner is totally different than here because we're not used to the claiming races. Excuse me. In my country, when you buy a horse, the horse practically becomes a member of the family. So we never sell it. We never put him in a claiming race. Actually, we don't have too many claiming races down in Venezuela. Excuse me. So it's difficult to try to train with that kind of mentality when you have to come here and put the horses in claiming races and you sell them and you lose them and you buy them. And I had to explain to my customer how the system was. And it took me a while. It took me a while to make them understand that here the business is totally different. It's a very dynamic market. You buy it, you sell, you don't keep the horses for too long. And most of the times you can make some profit of horses if you sell them or if you claim them. And in the first times, my people didn't understand that. But nowadays, they know how the business is here, how different it is. they've been keeping their support. But it was difficult in the beginning. They didn't understand that. But now they do, and they do it very good.
Talking with trainer Jose Garofalo on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Jose, you mentioned the name Red Former, the name of your very first winner back in 1999. And you told me you've had a lot of luck with horses with red in their name, including Wildcat Red, who won the Fountain of Youth this year at Gulfstream Park. But you're not a fan of the color red in any way.
No. Like I mentioned you before, I'm not a fan of the color red because of it's a political reason. The red is the color that identifies the communism, and in my country now we have a very, very bad problem with the government who wants to install the communism in my country. So my people is fighting against that, and that's the reason why I don't like the color, the red, the color red. Even if I have good luck with the red names, you know. So that's the reason why. It's just a personal, it's a personal issue with the color, with the red color. But mostly because of, it's the color of revolution, what they call revolution, and I don't like that kind of system. I'm born in a free country with human rights and with the freedom to do anything. Now they want to put a lot of pressure on my country they want to put a lot of pressure on my country to install the communists. And they're fighting against that. And like I told you before, I think they're going to make it.
I know most of your family is back in Venezuela. Is it difficult for you to be here in the United States with that turmoil, with your family being back in Venezuela?
Yeah, we're very worried about them. Even if we have a lot of contact, I speak to my family almost every day. Thank God they're good, but you never forget them. So even if you're here and they're there, we always worry about them and about the situation in general in the country, especially for the kids. I have like some nephews and nieces, and I worry about their future. But sooner than later, they're gonna overcome all the problems. And I think that the country is gonna be in a better situation. But it's an issue for us here to think about our people down there. It's difficult, and it's always we always have them in our minds.
Wildcat Red is an amazing story right now in your barn, Jose. But would you say that a filly by the name of Yara, who won the Grade 2 Devona Dale Stakes in 2012, might be the one that kind of put you on the map, at least nationally?
Well, you know what? Every time you have a good horse, you think that then another one will come later. And that what happened with the Wildcat Red. When I had the Yara, she put me in the big races. And I always thought that after Yara, it was going to come another one. And now it's like I read the one who is giving me the chance to be in the big races and in the big screen here in the United States. And after like I read, I'm sure that there will be some more coming in the future. Because that's where you work. You work for a future. You think about, always think about to have a good horse. That's where we're working. It's why we're here. We got to have an illusion. We got to have a goal all the time. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here, in my opinion.
You know, it was interesting. After the Fountain of Youth, there was very little red in the winner's circle. There was a bright pink suit. There was yellow, bright yellow, but there was very little red. And, of course, those other colors worn by the owners of Wildcat Red. Talk about them and talk about the relationship you have.
Well, we started our relationship as friends because I was introduced by a common friend that we have in Venezuela. They never had a horse, a race horse before. They're very new in the business. So we started our relationship about a year or a year and a half ago with a cheap horse. The filly did something. She won a race, but they are animal lovers too. So they wanted to stay in the business, and that's why we bought Wildcat Red. But they're very nice people. I mentioned to you before that they are animal lovers. They spend a lot of money in foundations that take care of the animals in Venezuela. And they wanted to stay here. They wanted to stay in the business, in the horse business. And the second horse that they had was Wildcat Red. It's Wildcat Red now. So they're very new. They're very good people. They give me all the confidence, and they let me do my job, and that helps a lot when you have an owner that lets you do what you think you have to do and let you work, and they put all their confidence in what I'm doing, and that's a very good help.
How would you describe your training philosophy, Jose?
My training in general is very conservative. I take very good care of the horse. I don't breathe too much. I try to keep the horse in shape with gallops, strong gallops when the horse is needed. But I try to avoid to train the horses in the morning too fast. My breezes are very, very easy. I learn how to keep a horse in shape only with gallops, no breezes, because that make the horse last longer in most of the times. We are exposed to a lot of problems with the injuries, but if you're conservative with the training, these horses can last longer. And the key of the business is to have a horse that runs as many times as you can, because that's where the money is in the races. You don't do nothing breathing a horse in the morning that works a minute or 59, and it's going to last maybe two or three races, and you never see the horse running again. So that's why I think that I am very conservative with the training in the morning. So I think that's why that is part of my success, because I usually work with cheap horses, claiming horses, claimers, that they're not the best horses of the country, so I have to take an extra care of them. I have to keep them in shape and keep them sound. And my style of training, I think it fits to that kind of horses. So basically, I'm very conservative in my training.
Only a couple minutes left, Jose. I always like to end these Trainer Talk interviews by asking trainers what it is they like to do outside of horse racing. I know you probably don't get a lot of free time, but what other interests or hobbies does Jose Garofalo have?
Well, I like sports. First, I like baseball. I follow the baseball every season. I like the big leagues. I go a lot to the ball games. And I also like the beach. I enjoy the beach here in Florida every week. That's the reason why I live here in Florida, because we're close to the beach. And I'm very fan of the sports. I used to play baseball in my college, and I still enjoy playing softball once in a while with my friends here in Florida. So I like the sports in general. I go to the Dolphins games once in a while, which I love, and I go to the Marlins games all the time. I have a bunch of friends that are involved with baseball and with the major leagues, and I enjoy a lot being with them in the baseball season.
What position did you play in college?
Pardon me?
What position did you play in college?
I play. For my college, until I played baseball, until I graduated, maybe in 1988, I was a catcher in my team, and I play A class. I played double A. My country.
Oh wow! Well, did you have a favorite player growing up that you idolized?
Pardon me?
Did you have a favorite player growing up that you looked up to?
Yeah, a lot of them. I like, you remember Andrés Galarraga? He was one of my favorite players.
Sure.
And before we had a good shortstop, Venezuelan shortstop, maybe you remember him, Dave Concepcion, used to play for the Reds, for Cincinnati.
Sure.
I used to follow him a lot. Then we had, remember Ozzie Guillén?
Sure,
I used to follow him a lot. Omar Vizquel, a lot of them. I followed the baseball since I was a kid.
Well,
I used to play since I was a since I was a child.
Well, Jose, I think you made the right career choice, my friend, and I want to wish you all the best moving forward with Wildcat Red and all the horses in your stable. Thanks so much for taking the time, and can't wait to see you again when I'm back in Florida.
Mike, thank you very much, and you will be welcome here anytime you come. Okay, so thanks for having me again, and thanks for everybody to listen at your program.
Thanks, Jose.
You guys have a good day.
Thanks, you too. Jose Garofalo here on Trainer Talk. Want to thank Bill Kaplan, Jose, my producer, Lee Delapina. I'm Mike Pennell. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk.